You're listening to the Thoroughly Good Classical Music Podcast. My name is John Jacob. A new film of soprano Maria Callas's 1958 One Night Paris debut is exclusively available in UK cinemas on the 11th, 12th and 22nd of November 2023. This restored film draws on recently discovered material, film which nobody thought even existed, that captured the original live black and white broadcast from 1958. Over a 2-year period, 130,000 frames of film has been painstakingly restored and colorized, drawing on original color photographs of the event, and that has been combined with a remastered Dolby Atmos audio track. It is a stunning watch. In this podcast, director, producer and lifelong bel canto devotee Tom Wolfe talks about his love of opera, his dedication to preserving Maria Callas's legacy, and the production work involved in producing Callas, Paris, 1958.
I became much more aware of Maria Callas back in 2013 when I was living in New York, and I have attended a performance at the Metropolitan Opera of the first bel canto opera I have ever attended, which was Maria Stuarda with Joyce DiDonato. And that was a revelation of its own. And coming back to my little room that night, I was looking for anything related to bel canto and Donizetti, and came across the very first time I have heard a recording of Maria Callas singing Lucia, the mad scene. And that was a second revelation the same night, and that led me on to a journey that was first a journey of wanting to know more and discover and get an interest both about the woman and the artist at the same time. And destiny, which I believe in, made it that I would encounter friends of Callas, people who knew her, starting in New York and then eventually all around the world, traveled across Europe and other countries to meet people who knew her, who were friends of hers. And that led on the work that I have started with the first film that I've directed and created, Maria by Callas, came out in 2017. The first film, which was entirely in her own words, entirely made out of archives, with a trove of material that had never been seen or heard before, that was entrusted to me by her friends mostly, and that was also the fruit of a tremendous amount of research that I've carried out. And now we're in the end of 2023, and we're bringing to the cinema a historical performance in a completely new image and sound, that is the Paris debut of 1958.
Well, what did you see? What did you observe in that revelation when you first were exposed to bel canto?
I think it was the first time that I was exposed to theatre in music. And it's only years later that I learned more about the origin of bel canto and the teatro musicale, which was what opera was about, which was theatre in music, you know. And that revelation, that experience of hearing fantastic, beautiful melodies, breathtaking music, whilst at the same time, simultaneously, breathtaking acting, sheer drama on stage with breathtaking costumes and sets and lights. And it felt like, I mean, I was always a great cinema and film lover, but this felt like cinema and theater and music all at the same time and all in four dimensions. So it was really mind-blowing as a first experience. When you listen to Callas, and even furthermore when you see her, the performance of Paris 58 is a great example, you actually see and hear theater in music. She was an artist that couldn't differentiate singing and, you know, being respectful to the score and finding all the subtleties musically as a great musician that she was, from the acting and the in personification of the character and bringing a character like Norma or like Tosca to life through music, that is this very particular merging of music and theater and interpretation and expression and emotion all at the same time. And that is what makes her a unique artist. That is what made her a fascinating artist in her lifetime, and even since, even decades later, she still exercises that fascination because she provokes a momentum when we hear it, especially when we see her, that is really unlike any other. And she has revolutionized opera. She has revived many operas that have been long forgotten, and she has given birth to a whole lineage of artists that carried on following her legacy.
I've watched the first part of the film, and the first observation I made was that it felt as though this was a bygone era that we will never see again. Wow, there was so much glamour around opera and a lot of glamour around the event. The other thing that really struck me was that actually I find her quite terrifying. On stage, she owns stage and almost milks the applause when she stands on stage.
She was a sacred monster. Back in 1958, she had already attained this sort of status, which was absolutely unique, even in the days, that an opera singer would make headlines of all the major newspapers all around the world, that would be known all around the world, and not only by opera lovers and opera goers, but by everyone, by the large public. She was a superstar. And I think that she is at the same time in 1958 at the peak of her stardom, shall we say, and at the peak of her career, although it is a pivotal year for her, and we could go back into that if you'd like, since the early days of 1958 until the culmination of this Paris debut in December. A lot of things have happened, and this is a pivotal moment for her, that it is a Paris debut, but it also is a live broadcast all across Europe, a technological feat for those days to be able to do that. And she knows that she's watched and observed by everyone. It's like a global impact that she's very much aware of. And you were saying that she has a terrifying presence, but I think first and foremost, and maybe because over the years I've got to know her in a way, and to feel close to her and to understand her mindset, that I would say first and foremost that she was terrified herself. And she must have been. Actually, she says so in the very premises of the film. I've included some bits of interviews that that she gives as she arrives in Paris on the day before the performance. And she must have been terrified, because it was a challenge to give a performance knowing how much the whole world is watching and is expecting, and to have to be at the highest level whilst everyone thinks that you're this diva, divina. And she was just a human being, and she repeatedly said so, including in the beginning of the year, during and after the Rome walkout, the so-called Rome walkout, where she was accused of not being a human being, of, you know, not being a superwoman that could fight any bronchitis and colds, and why wouldn't she carry on and sing that Norma? So it's all the weight of that perception and that that global attention that was the quintessence during that night on December 19th, 1958.
I hadn't realised that it was a live broadcast across all of Europe. That presumably means it went out over the Eurovision network.
Exactly. It was one of the first Eurovisions, the live broadcast. 13 million people watching.
This was 2 years after they were trying out all sorts of different formats at that point in time. The song contest was one. There were various sort of collaborative broadcast across different broadcasters, and now this in 58. So does that, did that make it her first live broadcast?
It is. Yeah, she had had one very short broadcast just 1 year before, on the New Year's Eve, 1957. So that is the New Year's Eve from 1957 to 1958. Yeah. And they did a live broadcast of Casta Diva. So just one aria that she had performed in Rome just a couple of days before the infamous Rome walkout. But it is the first time that a whole full performance is live broadcast. And that gives you the dimension of the world fame the interest that that she provoked in audiences all across Europe, but actually all around the world. For that reason, she has crafted an evening like actually she has never done before or since. Meaning that she had performed fully staged operas on one side, and she had performed concert tours on another. And actually, throughout 1958, she does a big concert tour all around the world in major capitals, where she performs several arias of her repertoire. For the Paris debut, she crafts an evening in a very particular way, which is three large opera pieces, Norma, Trovatore, Barber of Seville. Not only the arias, but actually for Norma, she includes the recitativo and the cabaletta. So it's actually a very large chunk that gives a very wild glimpse into her portrayal of Norma, which was her battle horse, as she used to call it, the role that she preferred and the one she performed the most. A large piece of Trovatore with the aria and the Miserere, and the aria of Barber of Seville, of Rosina. And the whole second part of the evening is a fully staged second act of Tosca. So it is very peculiar. And she, I believe, wanted to show the world what she was made of, what she was capable of. So she would show the vastness of her operatic repertoire, going from Bel Canto all the way to Verismo, and her performance as a concert, as a recital artist, you know, the quintessence of the diva, shall we say, in the first half of the film. And the second half is really about theater, about drama. It's showing not only what a great interpreter she is musically and how she gives life to a character like Tosca, which is absolutely striking and full of drama, but also the acting and her looks, her gestures, things that made her performances so famous, that made people queue for days, you know, to get tickets for her performances. We get a glimpse of that, very close glimpse.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but when I heard the first half, I was sure that there was a moment where the chorus was out. There was a sequence where actually the chorus is not with her. Did I imagine that?
No,
is absolutely the case.
It is absolutely the case.
Because it was live.
Yeah, it was live. There was a moment, indeed.
A delicious moment. Because she doesn't waver.
Actually, what is fascinating is to watch her reaction to it and to watch how, remaining entirely in the character of Norma, she acknowledges that moment, and her looks and her gestures at this moment is sheer drama, sheer theater, and also makes you think how terrified she must have been that the whole show would collapse. And it didn't, miraculously.
How did you come by the films?
We start with a live broadcast that is a 3-hour television program that is broadcast live and not recorded. A very poor quality remains out of the broadcast that remains at the TV station. And as far as we knew up to now, this is the only, this dusty old black and white footage is the only surviving footage of that performance. So to my great amazement, 2 years ago, whilst recovering archives for the Maria Callas Foundation, of which one of the missions is to gather and recover archives and documents that belonged to Callas and bring it back to Paris under the protection of the Foundation, in eventually the goal of creating a Callas Museum. In the process of this, friends of hers call me to say that they have recovered boxes in their basement that they had brought from her apartment after she passed away. In those boxes, there are numerous reel-to-reel tapes, films, 16mm, Super 8, you name it, all sorts of vintage old mediums of audio and image. And we bring all this material to Paris. I take the time to sort it out. And eventually I come across a very peculiar format, which is a number of 16mm reels along with audio reels all together and unlabeled. And to make a long story short, these were the original 16mm reels and audio reels from that historical performance of 1958.
On 16mm film.
Yeah. And jeez. What is interesting is that I have since uncovered the whole story, that after the performance, the 16mm were given to Callas and she had brought it with her. So she has kept those reels with her for all these years. And since her passing, they have been kept in a basement for decades under the protection of close friends of hers.
I remember when I went to the BBC's Written Archive Centre, right, in order to do some research about the European Broadcasting Union, and I had access to all sorts of different files, and I had a whole trolley of folders provided for me in the reading room, and I remember how I felt when I went through that. I couldn't believe that I had that access, and it was magical. I hear from you about discovering a box full of films. How do you contain yourself? Because clearly you're really passionate about the subject. How did you manage yourself through that process?
It's part of this institutional ambition that I have started since 2017 with the Callas Foundation. And therefore, I consider it to be my privilege and duty to take care of recovering material like that.
Of course you do, but were you excited?
of course.
I mean, surely you must have been really, really excited.
To be honest, it didn't occur to me in the first place that it was what it was, because I didn't think for a second that there was a better quality recording of that historical performance. I thought that whatever is out there is whatever has been preserved. So it took me a while to actually undergo all the different processes of the first digitalization and restoration in high definition, to watch that image and see it so clearly, so vividly, as I had never before. And it really took me a moment to realize what it was that was actually there, and to hear the sound and to hear it so clearly and vividly again. I couldn't really believe it in the first place.
I'm at the boundaries of my knowledge and understanding about digitization of video, but 16mm film is a small format, and now this version, this colorized version, is in high definition. How do you take something that is in a small format and turn it into high definition? Because you're only working with essentially a low quality version.
Actually, it's a very good question. It's quite the contrary. So to have been able to recover the 16mm is precisely what allowed us to bring the film into 4K Ultra HD in the cinemas now in 2023. Because if it hadn't been film, there is no way. I mean, it's very limited what you can do in terms of upgrading, and it's artificial. Mm. Whereas what we did is that we actually scanned the actual film reel frame by frame in 4K. So what you see is really the very detailed quintessence of the actual film without any artificial upgrading, upscaling that was added onto it. Then there was a meticulous work by my co-producer Samuel François Steninger on the restoration and the colorization of the image, something that took 2 years and that was done frame by frame. So you have to think, a 90-minute film for the cinema is 130,000 frames. And using original color photographs, we have restored the colors frame by frame to make the film look as if it was naturally in its original colors.
That's a terrifying process. Are you generally an ambitious individual? Because that sounds like an ambitious project.
It was really ambitious. It was really daunting, but it was really a work of love. It was very fascinating and incredibly interesting process to be able to do that and to see the film gradually over all the different stages literally being brought back to life. And it was really like reviving Callas and bringing her back to life, and to think that people will be able to see that in the cinema and hear the immersive sound with great clarity and see that vivid color image in front of their eyes, and to think that they would be transported like in a time capsule to the Paris Opera in December 1958, it was really exhilarating. But I have to confess, until a couple of months ago when we actually saw the final complete outcome, it was really a daunting mission. And up to the very end, we didn't know if we could actually manage to achieve it, to make a complete live performance.
Is that some kind of jeopardy, though, that you're introducing here, or is that absolutely the case?
That's exactly how it felt, yeah.
And your response when you see it, is there an emotional response when you see the finished product?
A tremendous emotional response. And not only to see her so alive on the big screen with the sound that makes you feel like her voice is so close to you, it brings shivers. And even for someone who has worked for 10 years and who has listened and seen her time and time again, it was like rediscovering it all for the first time. And to see the audiences, that's really what moves me the most. To see in the audiences going out of the theaters, people who on one side have never really come across Maria Callas before and are here by curiosity or by chance, and to feel how mesmerized and moved they are coming out of the theater is really extremely gratifying. And on the other hand, the people who are like the know everything about Callas, and that, well, you're never gonna surprise me with anything, and they're here also probably out of curiosity. And those people who have seen and heard that very performance 100 times coming out with tears in their eyes saying, I have the feeling I have seen her for the very first time and heard her for the very first time, then, you know, it gives you a sense that all this work and all these efforts were worthwhile. I think that when you do something you love and that you're motivated by something greater than yourself and that you feel that you're taking part in the legacy of someone so much greater, it gives you extra energy. It also feels like you're following on the footsteps of someone who herself has considered herself to be a servant of her art, a servant of the composers, servant of something greater than hers, and following on the footsteps of someone who has set such high standards in opera, but in the arts in general, and to feel that you're contributing to this legacy, I mean, what a privilege. There's nothing to be tired about.